Garden State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate, no joke, no frills. Garden State Debate, it's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate, for people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate, Garden State Debate, Garden State Debate.
Hello, everyone. I am Ryan, and welcome to another episode of Garden State Debate. I believe this is episode 12. And it's just a quick plug for new viewers or listeners. Just a reminder, we try to make this show as educational and informational and sometimes entertaining as it might be for all the listeners and greater good of New Jersey. It's really just to get a platform to get some notable people and their ideas and what they advocate out for the greater good of New Jersey. And that's really the essence of this program. So we've had many, many guests up and down the state in terms of business, politics, healthcare, COVID-19, nonprofit groups and things like that. But today we have another very special guest with us today. Senator Declan O'Scanlan is joining us. He's a senator in the New Jersey legislature, District 13, which is, I guess, kind of south, a little southern New Jersey, in Monmouth area. And he's been a senator for the last, since 2018, last couple of years. Before that, in the New Jersey Assembly for approximately 10 years. And again, in the Monmouth area, which includes, you know, towns such as Asbury Park, Colts Neck, Long Branch, Red Bank, and a lot of popular...
Actually, none of those. None of those towns, but just north of that. My old district included some of those towns.
Oh, really? Okay.
I have to correct you vehemently, actually, because you did just offend me by including Monmouth County in South Jersey. We are Central Jersey. It does exist, and we are the prominent member of the Central Jersey counties.
I appreciate that. I think there's like a raging debate going on in central versus, is there a central and where does it start and where does it end? What are some of the towns that are in your district then?
So I'm the Bayshore area of Monmouth County. So just sort of northeast of those areas that you mentioned. I did used to represent a number of those towns. My dad, my 91-year-old dad, lives in Colts Neck, and he's kind of pissed off that he doesn't get to vote for me anymore. Redistricting is going to happen again this year, we hope. So maybe I'll get some of them back. So at the southern end, you have Little Silver, where I live, Oceanport, Monmouth Beach, and I won't name all the towns.
There's 16. Yeah.
But then we go right up through Seabright, Middletown, and all up the Bayshore, all the way up to Keyport, Keensburg, Union Beach, and then it curves back around to Aberdeen and to Marlboro and in between. So it's a great area to represent. A real microcosm of the state of New Jersey. But we care about some of the other places you mentioned. If you're a good legislator, you're not just a lobbyist for your district. You care about New Jersey as a whole. And certainly for Monmouth County, we are Monmouth legislators on both sides of the aisle, actually, I'll say. We get calls from people throughout Monmouth County, throughout the state. But those are the areas I represent directly. And it's a great, great people to represent. We got through, we were one of the hardest hit areas during Sandy. And that has been up till now, up till COVID, was the single greatest, most satisfying period of public service in my life that I never want to go through again. And now COVID has eclipsed that as being an even bigger challenge. And it's satisfying because we helped a lot of people. But again, I hope I'm long gone before I get to use this institutional knowledge again. I don't want to do it ever again. But
certainly, yeah. No, it's. I feel like all of these kind of podcasts or whatever you call it, they come back to the pandemic, no matter what we're talking about. It's like, well, how are you doing it in reference to coronavirus and what we're going through now? But just to kind of continue that. And hopefully I'm right on this. You're on the Senate Budget Committee and Law and Public Safety Committee, as well as the Community and Urban Affairs Committee. Did I get that one right?
That's right.
Okay. Yes. So today I hope we could talk about just a couple of kind of pressing topics. I think one general thing that a lot of people would love to know is, you know, we've heard a lot of direct communication from the governor, especially over the last 8 months, in terms of policy and communication and things like that. And, you know, just anecdotally and in the media, even you see a lot of people saying like, where is the legislature? Are they pushing back? Are they, you know, what are they doing on a day-to-day basis? Like kind of what are the, what's behind the curtain, what's going on in terms of that relationship, what they're trying to do and things like that. So I hope we could touch on that. And then also, obviously the newest and latest and greatest on the cannabis referendum that passed in the most recent vote here in New Jersey. And I know that you've been part of that as it relates to your Senate Budget Committee duties and some recent meetings. So I hope we can dive into that and get some perspective on the kind of, I know there's a lot of moving pieces that are not done moving, but you can educate us on that. Maybe some other current bills or things that you're advocating for. And then we'll just wrap it up and see what the future might hold. If you can give us a little bit of a window into what you're looking forward to in the 2021. Does that sound good? Welcome to the show, by the way. And I'm sorry about butchering your district. I did not mean to do that.
It's all right.
We're all neighbors.
Most people don't know who their legislators are. Most people certainly don't know what the district lines are, what towns in what district. So
it's tough to get the whole map sheet.
You've proven you're a real person with concerns focused on the right places.
Great. Thank you for that. So let's just, if we could just start off, can you just break down, it's a kind of a packed question, but to the people that say, you know, where has the legislature been? What are they working on over the last 8 months while we've been hearing from the governor? And kind of what's the relationship amongst yourselves? I know you're Republicans, so you're in the minority party of the legislature. So there's different dynamics. Maybe you can just kind of begin to walk us through how it started to develop and let us know if you're not doing anything as people say.
We're sitting around every day. If I don't have my first martini by 10:30 in the morning, it's a long day. there are people that assume that. Anybody paying attention, taking the time to pay attention, will see our relentless pursuit of good policy throughout the pandemic. It's interesting, you do get some Twitter trolls who assume that they're seeing all of the world, yet they're not paying any attention to the tons of press releases, press appearances. Certainly social media posts, which have an impact, are happening. We've been relentless since the very beginning of this. And I think if you interviewed the governor, he would tell you that Republicans in general, certainly me personally, have been relentless and pushing the administration where I think they're wrong, praising them where I think they're right. We, right from the start, I developed a text string of restaurateurs and a batch of other business folks that we've been talking to. We went right into being a resource, my office, for people who were not getting their unemployment. We're still helping people every day do that. And we've helped, it's more than 1,000 now, people get through that process. It's been the longest days I've ever spent and the longest period of the longest days I've ever spent on the legislature and on these critical issues. And we've been effective. We made the case, but first to start making the case early on, that the focus wasn't the 4th of July, it wasn't June 1st, it was Memorial Day. If you're gonna preserve our shore businesses, that needed to be your focus in talking about reopening. If there's a way to do it safely, that needed to be your focus. We showed there was a way, we had enough evidence showing there was a way to do plenty of reopenings by then. And we moved the administration forward in that thinking, I think very effectively. We were irritating, we were persuasive, but we did move it. And right along, I think we've helped push the administration where we can in outdoor dining first, in indoor dining second. Now, for a lot of these folks, unless it's perfect, it means we failed. So there's no way to not fail within the eyes of these unsatiable people. But I know we've made a huge difference. I think the governor would probably admit that. We have had moments where we've really tangled, and I've done that with every governor. I can be kind of irritating, but that's part of my job. When I think I'm right on policy, I push it. I'm also perpetually open-minded. If you make a better argument about policy, I'm open-minded. But you got to make the argument. And with COVID, the science has to back up your argument. If it doesn't, I'm pretty relentless. So the governor and I have had our moments where we've really been at each other's throats. We've also had moments that are really compassionate, and this is behind the curtain, really shown we care about each other, each other's families. So I'm happy with where that relationship is. Someone just attacked the governor the other day. And look, with his family, I have no problem attacking on policy and pushing envelopes loudly and strongly. And sometimes the governor finds offensively. I don't think I've crossed that line, but maybe he has. But I also, on the flip side, need to be there. We need to treat the governor and his family as the decent human beings they are. Again, I have fierce disagreements with him about some policy, and I've made no bones about that. And there's been times when he hasn't treated businesses as decently as he should have. On the flip side, we don't, those policy disagreements are not carte blanche to attack the governor's family when they're out socially with foul language and in almost a threatening manner. That not going to stand for that. I'll be vocal in their defense as well. We've worked really hard to get back to your original question.
Yeah.
What's going on in the background, the black box, and we've moved policy. We continue to move policy. And I like what I've heard. I was on a call with the governor just yesterday, and things we've been calling for quite a while, the governor articulated. He did it to the whole group of legislators, so I don't think I'm out of school when I say it, and I don't think he'd mind either, that his goal is to not have more lockdowns. His goal is to be surgical, the way we've asked now for quite some time, to focus on areas where we do see evidence of rates of transmission and spread rather than comprehensive lockdowns. He said that about small businesses, about restaurants in particular, about schools. And that is music to my ears. And I applaud that. That hasn't always been the case. And we pushed to make our approach more surgical and more transparent and more scientifically driven. And I'm happy to say that there's been response. The governor may say that our input had nothing to do with it, and I don't really care as long as we're going in the right direction.
No, that's great. And you made a lot of good points, but especially at the end there, right? So, and obviously in the beginning, it was kind of like a blindsided situation. So you can't blame many people for anything as everyone was scattering to get things together. But then we went through that down period of time that you talked about where sounds like you were fighting for a lot of kind of pro-business, safe, health-guided, you know, data-determined dates type stuff. And it was time to lift things. And that's when you stepped in. And now here we are, end of November, around Thanksgiving, headed into the end of the year. And people are, you know, health experts and whatnot, as good or bad as they might be with their models are and what we see, the cases are back up, people are crying, you know, and rightfully so in some ways. But I think residents, the public has noticed a difference as well. If this was several months ago and we were having clicking off 4,000 or 5,000 cases a day, which we have now for weeks, there was completely different actions that we noticed. And now it's more, like you said, surgical. So you think that you're saying that the legislature hasn't been involved in involving that kind of approach. I mean, that's a complete change in mindset for like a state to have, I think, right? So
it is. And I think we'd be effective in making that case. And I'm glad you mentioned both. We're pro-business, we're also pro-health. But you need the scientific evidence to drive both of the sides of that policy. And we've seen, I think there's been a dramatic evolution in thought on part of the administration. Look, I don't fault the governor initially for the lockdown, because we all, as you mentioned, we're scrambling, we're human beings. We didn't know at the time what the rate of death was going to be from this, the rate of hospitalization was going to be. So I don't fault the initial lockdown. But as we move forward, we need to acknowledge that the lockdown itself has negative health impacts. The governor liked to say early on, still does, that public health drives economic health. And I said, it goes both ways. Economic health drives public health too. And neither one to the exclusion of the other. So it's gotta be a balance. And what we do needs to be scientifically justifiable. And if we're gonna put restrictions on people, if you want them to buy in, you need to build credibility. To build credibility, you need to be transparent and demonstrate the scientific justification for your action. The administration didn't do that well enough. For the first half of this, they didn't. And we pushed hard to have more of that. I'm still pushing there. But that's part of our job. And we've been really effective in, I think, making the public case for that. Not everybody sees it. Not everybody understands. I still get attacked by some people saying that I'm going to sacrifice lives so that people can go out and have a candlelit dinner. Well, no, that's not what we're talking about. We need to net preserve the greatest amount of public health that we can. And lockdowns and bankruptcies and economic threat have huge negative health impacts. So those people forget that. The administration had it wrong too at some points, telling folks in the restaurant industry, you know, we're not going to kill people so you go out and have your candlelight, so you have the convenience of a night out. Well, no, there are people's lives and livelihoods based on these industries. There are blue collar workers. There are bartenders and busboys and servers who feed their families with these jobs. So we need to understand the whole holistic aspect of what we're trying to do, what we're trying to advocate for, and the impact, the collateral impact and reverberation that our actions have. So we can't lock down and not understand the negative impact that will come along with that and weigh the two. And they're tough issues. And there's another area where I'll be compassionate with the governor. These are tough issues. When he ran for governor, nobody ran for this and these issues and facing these challenges. It's a tough, tough thing. And it's a huge burden that very few until this have faced, and it's on all of us. So I have some compassion.
That's a good point. No one signed up for the worst health pandemic that we've seen in our lifetimes. I don't want to cover the past 2022 in too much detail, but I did have a couple questions because I'm thinking that you're probably involved in some of these discussions. And that's related to the budget as well as the CARES Act funding that New Jersey received. I guess we can start with the budget. Did you have an overall, the budget was, as I understand it, we pushed back their fiscal year. It was the only state in the union that did that. That might be related to something that you could help educate us on. And then we passed a budget that was pretty flat in terms of the size of it, in terms of from last year to this year. And, people write about things like Christmas tree items and knocking things out that should be in there and whatnot. And, it's, from what I understand, one of the most important responsibilities of the legislature is to approve the budget. So it had to go through the Senate. So what are your thoughts on the 2021 full year New Jersey budget? Just in general, you don't have to break it down. Just anything general that comes to mind that you either advocated for, didn't like, some high profile type things that you liked, didn't like, or any comments would be appreciated.
If there was ever a time in our history where our focus should be on fiscal responsibility, it's now, with all the challenges that we've had. And this budget is not. It is bloated. It doesn't take advantage of savings opportunities. It ridiculously borrows money to put into a surplus. Well, it's not a surplus. You don't, at the end of the year, decide you want to feel better about your own personal fiscal health by having some money in the bank, by taking a few thousand dollars out of your credit card and put it in the bank and feel better about your fiscal position, which is what New Jersey did and has done. So I was very vehemently, Republicans very vehemently against this budget.
Right. There was also the emergency borrowing, and I failed to mention that came in, and I think that was a highly covered thing. Do you think that the emergency borrowing of, I think it was what, they're authorized up to $9 billion and did four, something like that. Is that something that you were for, against?
Over four. I was against unnecessary borrowing. You may, if you'd gone through this budget and been responsible, figured out that you had, you know, maybe $1 billion or so, if you do the real math, which I did, which you a hole that you had to fill or potentially had to fill. And that could have been a combination of revenue, which would probably be my last choice, and borrowing. We didn't do that. We didn't do any pencil sharpening. We went right to any shortfall that we imagined. We're just going to borrow money to fill that hole. And we overestimated the hole. And we knew that before we passed the budget. The administration's revenue estimates from the beginning, and at the beginning, it seemed like we were going to have some serious revenue challenges with the fall off in the economy. But as we moved forward and as we reopened and as we saw some bouncing back of the stock market, we knew that the revenue estimates and the revenue shortfalls were dramatically off. And the administration continued to rely on the revenue estimates that they made early on, right when we started down this path. And they were already proven wrong. Our sales tax, where they were projecting in given quarters a shortfall, was already exceeding the previous year and the previous estimates. So that was wildly irresponsible. And again, you should limit the amount you borrow, limit the amount of taxes you increase as much as you possibly can, especially in times like now. But overall in New Jersey, we should do that because the path we've been down for the past 25 years of profligate spending that has dug the deep financial hole that we're in. But now in particular, we should have done that. And Republicans put out a sound plan that would have virtually eliminated the borrowing and the tax increases. And it was rejected by Democrats in the legislature and by the governor. They decided to take the easy way out, which will set them up, by the way, for a budget next year that will help their reelection. That's part of what's motivating here. They'll be able to say, we're not raising any taxes next year. We're not borrowing anything next year because we did it all this year. And they'll hope that voters will fall for that and believe that they've been responsible when they haven't. They just have been doubly irresponsible this year to get them through next year as well. And then the chickens will come home to roost in years after that. We earners now, taxpayers now, and our children and our grandchildren will be paying the fiscal reverberation for the fiscal reverberations of the irresponsibility that we showed this year, billions of dollars. And that's a huge problem.
Yeah, understood. And related to that, And you probably have similar comments, but maybe anything else specific on the CARES Act funding that we've received as a state. You know, you see a lot of different things in the media. You know, we're hanging on to, you know, we've only spent 3%, we've only spent 10%, but the rest is earmarked, but it has to be spent by the end of the year. I mean, can you dispel any of these rumors and or provide any insight onto how you see the CARES Act funding that I think it was, $1.4 billion, something like that, of just your perspective on New Jersey's funding, what we got, what we're doing with it, what we should be doing with it, and where we're at.
I won't dispel those rumors. I will substantiate those rumors. We've been wildly irresponsible in our hesitancy or failure to get the CARES Act money into the hands of people that need it, small businesses especially. For small businesses and nonprofits, it's over $2 billion in CARES Act money. New Jersey has been the slowest state to distribute that money. These people are dying right now. We should have programs that's putting money into folks who are suffering because of lockdown, because of restrictions. We should be doing all we can to backfill as much as we can. There are additional costs that have come from this, and we're not. And again, we've been the slowest to distribute this money out of all 50 states. I haven't checked that in the last few weeks, but I'm pretty sure that's still the case. It has been. And we still have more than, I think, $1.5 billion of that $2+ billion to get out. And most of it is not earmarked yet, other than for these wide categories. And that's a shame. And that's been a real failure on our part as a state. So that's something we got to continue to work on. And we continue to press the administration on those fronts.
And one question that I meant to ask earlier, you kind of alluding to it through your natural discourse, but being in the minority party of the legislature and working on some of these things and some of your thoughts that you've already said, and we're going to talk about a couple more before we do. Should people think that, is it a bipartisan nature of you and your colleagues in terms of pushing for some of these things? Some of the, what you've mentioned about the budget or CARES Act, can you kind of give us some insight as to how these discussions go? And if it's a bipartisan kind of group of people, or if it's an uphill battle, or probably a combination of the two. But I think people would like to know, you know, if Senator O'Scanlan has all these great ideas to, you know.
We will stipulate that all my ideas are good. So
he might have some bad ones, but what if he has one good one? How can he get it through with his colleagues? I mean, that's kind of where I'm going with it, you know?
Fair enough. And it's a combination. You, as a member of the minority party, you don't have easy access to power. You're not controlling the agenda or bills that are heard. So you have to figure out and do the harder work to give yourself an outsized voice and to influence policy. How do you do that? You form relationships with key people on the other side of the aisle. And you need to do that without selling out. So I think I mentioned earlier, I can be kind of aggressive and kind of irritating. And that needs to be balanced with being a good ally when people on the other side of the aisle who are in control need you. And I think I've done a pretty good job at that. Senator Sweeney and I have a really good relationship, yet I don't hesitate to very loudly and vocally be a pain in the ass when I think he's wrong. You do that. And then you figure out how to have more influence within the community. You do the very hard work of connecting with editorial boards and on social media with large groups of people and build credibility with those folks. And I think I've done that as well. So you can marshal those forces when you think we're making a mistake or when you think you have something you want to push. There are times when my good friends on the other side of the aisle ignore Republicans. And then find out they need us and then bring policy to us that we're going to block because they've screwed it up already. Cannabis, by the way, several times, or at least once now, has happened like that. And then they figure out they need some votes. And it's like, we just need you guys to vote for this. And we're like, well, no, you didn't include us from the start. Sorry, you're going to have to approve the legislation or it's going to fail.
That's a good segue. Let's move into that then. The cannabis legislation that's going on right now, if you don't mind.
Sure.
As of right now, there's a lot of moving parts, like we said, right? And it's part of the budget committee. Is that where it's coming into play right now? There's some discourse and meetings as recently as last week where folks like yourselves in the committee have had a chance to opine on where it's currently sitting. So maybe you can just walk us through from, I don't know, where it started, these conversations to this bill, and then maybe we can break down where the bill stands. It sounds like there's a lot of amendments that are like, were coming in even during that most recent meeting, and you guys are like, hands tied, but there's a lot of important things that'll probably be in it that won't change. So we can talk about those as well. And also I saw that, I think I saw a picture, speaking of social media, of some White Castle hamburgers. Is that part of the bill, or was that just lunch?
We don't mandate White Castle hamburger availability in the bill. Okay. But I did, look, we don't want to take ourselves too seriously. There's a lot of very serious issues around cannabis, recreational cannabis legalization. But we ought not take ourselves too seriously. So as much as I'm a very fierce fighter over policy, you also got to have a sense of humor. I did show up at the State House with a Crave case of White Castle to celebrate our beginning of our debate in the budget committee. A big hit on both sides of the aisle. It was a big hit. Look, let's start with the serious policy. We have over 60% of the people of New Jersey have voted that they want recreational legalization. I've been studying this issue for a long time. I come from a very conservative district with a lot of people that have serious concerns about the impact on addiction issues, road safety issues, and over all issues of our children's health. A lot of constituents with legitimate concerns. I think we can answer those as we go forward. The sheriff of Monmouth County, Sean Golden, has been at the forefront of articulating some concerns about roadway safety, the ability to test people, impaired driving, and some of the greater issues about the implications of drug enforcement in general. Been really articulate. We've been a good set of partners on that, on these fronts. And I've worked hard to bring those concerns to the table. But people have voted. Recreational is going to come. If that's the case, we need to make sure that we understand the mission here. And job one needs to be to crush the black market, which is the source of not only marijuana, laced with God knows what, that any of our children in high school can get today if they want it. We need to crush that black market. It also provides huge amounts of money to cartels, leads to crime, leads to pushing other stronger drugs on our children. We have an opportunity here with legalization of recreational cannabis to crush that market, to crush that revenue stream. It needs to be job one, which leads us to a focus on how do you do that. And in order to do that, you need to keep prices down. You need to make legal product convenient and available. And that should be our main focus. Unfortunately, the bill that's floating around out there doesn't do that. The constitutional question and amendment seemed to suggest there was a focus on this. It suggested all we were going to do was provide sales tax, and certainly suggested this strongly, whether it did technically or not is a debate we'll have. But it suggested strongly that we would keep taxes low, which means you're going to keep prices low, which means you're going to crush the black market from a competitive pricing standpoint. But the bill doesn't do that. It adds on an excise tax, which was not mentioned at all in the constitutional amendment, another set of layers of the 2% local tax, where the constitutional amendment pretty much suggested there'd be one level where you'd apply that tax. So that's some of the reasons why I voted no. The bill, as too many of my friends' efforts on the other side of the aisle, is overtaxed, overregulated, overcomplicated, to the point where we're not serving the best interests of our constituents. And I have a problem with that.
Not to interrupt, just to level set, it was, like you said, it was past 60%. A lot of the essence of the bill from the public is decriminalization and like you said, getting rid of the black market. So that's kind of the essence of what I believe many people voted for it, you know. And what you're saying is, and then with that, it said, okay, it'll be, you know, there's a sales tax 6.25%, or whatever, same sales tax as anything else. and then municipalities would have like a 2% tax that they could charge. So what you're saying is the bill doesn't say that. It's
Takes if your math, if a lay person is going to take your math at face value, you'd be under 10% tax. If you look out at the market, we've done a lot of research here. If you're more than 25% above market value, street market value of illicit quantities of marijuana, you're going to open the door to people deciding to continue to buy from the illegal market. And we've seen this in other states. California is one of them, where they have a thriving illegal illicit market subsequent to their efforts to legalize recreational use cannabis. And that with all the problems that I've already outlined. So we should learn from that. So we'd be under 10%, which would be one of the lowest taxes in the country. But if you look at the other layers that the Democrat bill puts onto marijuana, we could be at 60% at some point, and it is variable depending on market value.
Yeah, and to get to the 60, I think I understand the 2% that was originally thought of as a municipal tax. If a community takes it on, you're saying that the handover from one to maybe growing it to selling it, all the different layers of the distribution channel, you can now add 2% all the way through. Is that what you're saying, or in different places?
Exactly. The 2% would be at every transfer level. So you have growers, which are now called cultivators, to make it sound sophisticated, hand off to processors, who then hand off to retailers or to wholesale. You can have four steps. And there's 2% at each step, which was not implied in.
And then also, that's I think, information that people need to know, as well as the excise tax. That's like kind of brand new. Can you break down what the excise tax, give us an example of, because that sounds like the game changer in terms of making this.
It's huge. And it was completely not in the constitutional amendment at all. And the excise tax can be over $40 an ounce. If you get down to lower prices, like $150, I think is in the lowest tier of price, the excise tax would go up to I think $40, $42 an ounce, and amount to a 60% tax if you add that in with the other taxes as well.
So when you say, real quick, $150 transaction, is that between an individual and a distributor? Or
now, the way the excise tax is, if you're at higher street prices of $350 or more, the excise tax would be lower. I think $10 where it starts. Don't hold me to this because there's a lot of moving parts here. As prices come down, which they tend to do once you institute a legalized market, there is at least some competition with the illicit market. Everybody lowers their prices, which if they go down to $150, the excise tax goes up. There's a batch of technical reasons why they want to do that, because they want continuity of the taxes coming from cannabis for really state purposes. But the bottom line is you can't get away from the market influence of these price fluctuations. And if you're going to add 60% to the street price of this product, you're going to drive people to the illicit market in droves. So our goal to begin with needs to be no focus on the revenue. It shouldn't be about revenue. It should be about children's health. It should be about crime reduction. It should be about crushing the illicit market and destroying that. You don't see people with alcohol today going out there and pushing it to our kids. Now they get it from our liquor cabinets too frequently, but there is no organized effort to push alcohol to our kids. There are liquor stores very close to schools, and we don't worry about it. We don't worry about people coming out of a liquor store and trying to sell cans of beer to kids as they lose schools. We have to make marijuana and the stigmatization of sales to our kids, et cetera, the same level of alcohol. The way to do that is to keep the prices down, keep supply reasonable, convenient, and then focus enforcement at the very few areas where you'll still see some of that. That should be our goal. This bill doesn't do it. This bill goes really against that philosophy completely. It focuses way too much on revenue, which we should be focused on at all. Revenue should be absolutely irrelevant.
Got it. A couple more questions on that. Is there a certain amount of, I think at some point there was caps on the amount of distributors or whatever the proper term
is? There's an effort. So we're leaving up to the Cannabis Regulatory Commission, which has already been created, up to them about distributorships. There was some talk about capping those. I don't think we formally tried to do that in the bill. The bill does, though, try to restrict cultivators. That's a problem. You could probably come up with some number that we wouldn't exceed anyway over a certain period of time. But you want to keep prices down. So you want to have as laissez-faire regulations and restrictions as possible. There is an effort to cap cultivators and add a number too low at this point.
Good distinction though between cultivators, even though that still can be an issue, and distributors. So technically it could be in every municipality if it was allowed in, but from a distribution standpoint, but not from a cultivation.
So that's, we should comment, yes, as much as I'm against those restrictions from the top down, I defend municipalities' rights to host facilities or not. We do have some municipalities where local officials, local community are really warm and welcoming to this industry. We have others which definitely do not want to participate, and they each should have that right locally.
That was one of my questions, being that I live in a municipality and a lot of them are undergoing or these discussions. They point to the fact that they voted for it. And then, you know, you could have your local government saying, well, we're putting in an ordinance and we're not allowing it. Does it come down to some of those things that you said, that the concerns that you said some of your constituents have, such as getting in the hands of our kids or traffic? Are these obviously these are credible issues, but is it a knowledge gap? And can a distributor be in a wealthy area, a poverty area? You know, do they belong in a certain place in the state? You know what I'm trying to get at, or types of decisions go into these things?
For the most part, the concerns, sometimes counterintuitively, are not particularly significant. If you look at states that have already, and some of them are years ahead of us, move forward with recreational use, kids' use of marijuana doesn't move at all or moves marginally downward. You wouldn't expect that, but you can understand it if you do remove a chunk of the illicit market, or you're successful in really battling the illicit market, you remove the incentive for people to push these drugs to our kids, because people don't want to lose their hard-fought license to sell legally. It's interesting to see that. But you don't see any increase in underage use of marijuana or other drugs once you legalize. So a lot of counterintuitive aspects. And some of the other concerns, you know, what element is going to become, you hear folks say this on a regular basis, who's going to come to these places? You don't see that for the most part. We've seen it with other things. Methadone clinics, for instance, were a big concern for people and folks not wanting those facilities in their backyard. And I have municipalities where there were real battles and concerns. It's going to destroy a municipality by having a facility. They go in, and not one of them so far, knock on wood, in New Jersey has caused a problem. You could talk to the local police, and they're like, even they thought that they were going to have issues and calls, and they don't. So people need to take a breath. This isn't going to destroy your municipality, no matter how this works. But they still should have a right, if they're concerned, to say no. And the bill includes that right, and I'll fight to maintain it. I will also, though, push folks to remain open-minded and wait and see how this goes. And there's also different aspects of the industry. There's cultivators, which is mostly indoors. There's processors, and then there's retail. Excuse me. And they should take a look and go in with their eyes open. And I would encourage that. But at the end of the day, it should be up to local municipal officials responding to their local folks. And I respect that right and will fight hard to defend it.
Understood. I think that's a good point. And just have a very good friend out in Colorado. I believe you guys took a trip out in Colorado as well. I kind of did a little preempt on him to see, you know, he's not a user, but like, what does he think is going on? He's like, you see them in rich areas, you see them in poor areas, you see them in strip malls next to a grocery store, you see them in communities. He's like, it's not like you walk by a marijuana dispensary and you're like, oh, now that it's legal, I just need to go in. It's like, that would be the equivalent of something like you said of from an alcohol standpoint. Like if you don't like it, you're not going to walk by a liquor store and be like, oh, I have to go in now. You know, they're already, to your first point in the top of the discussion, it's already widely available for people who want it. So getting the black market out of things and doing it responsibly for those who you know, for the public that voted for it and cities that can put the right things around it kind of makes sense to me.
Yeah, it's, you're right on all those points. Where you see maybe a potential concern, and again, getting back to some of my constituents that have these concerns, and my sheriff here in Monmouth County has been articulate, a really fair point is the people that will be a problem with marijuana usage, it's us. It's fairly sophisticated suburbanites who, because it's illegal, are not doing it right now, who, once it's legal, may decide to experiment and may get in over our heads or may get behind the wheel of a car. So that's a legitimate concern. There'll be a group of folks that do that. So you need money for drug recognition experts. You need some money to make sure that we attach the same stigma to marijuana usage as we do to alcohol. Don't get behind the wheel of your car. And we'll have a transition period where that group of people that isn't using now that might want to experiment with it does and learns from it. And we need to make sure that we guard people's safety during that transition. But that's not illegitimate. There will be some.
No, that's a great point. I wanted to ask you also about something you're getting at with the, where should the money go in terms of the taxes? And then the last question before we kind of segue is like, how long would people expect before something is up and running in New Jersey?
Okay. Based on you're a year to 2 years before any wide availability of recreational. You may, with if we permit the medical folks to sell licenses right now, who can ramp up use as quick as quickly. And by the way, medical is near and dear to my heart. And we have patients that are concerned about medical availability being displaced. And I'm going to have to jump within a couple of minutes here. I apologize. But yeah. I want to come back and do another hour. This has been great. And I love the in-depth discussion, Ryan. It's fantastic. But there are areas in the bill where we outline that medical needs to be served first. So people should take some comfort there. As far as the availability, it's really going to be a year to 2 years before there's wide availability. Probably the sweet spot is, you know, 10, 11, 12 months through 18 months. And I'm sorry, what was the other aspect of your question?
The where should the money be going? Obviously,
important stuff. So
theories and things like that.
To drug recognition experts, is an area where I've said, but also as we do move this forward and there is some substantial tax revenue, any substantial tax revenue, I've argued we shouldn't squander this. We have a structural deficit that is going to be really, really tough to fill over the next few years, made more so by the governor's last few budgets. But the money ought to be dedicated in the bill to areas that will reduce our structural deficit. There's also a fair argument for some social justice aspect of the money, going back to some of the communities that have been impacted by our current state of the law of marijuana. I'll grant some of that. but those are the areas where it should go. It shouldn't just end up in the falling into the black hole of our general fund, because it'll be gone and squandered.
I know you got to leave soon, so I want to hit you with a couple other ones before you jump, if you don't mind. I think the cannabis discussion is very educational. Everyone's learning as we hear from folks like yourself. So thank you for that. But I think there's a lot more to be discussed. Unfortunately, we can't do it, like you said. In the future, I'm sure there'll be more developments. We'll do that. But a couple quick ones. Do you consider yourself a moderate Republican?
You know, I consider myself a fairly conservative Republican. Some people apply some moderate, try to hit me with a moderate or rhino. Absolutely not the case. I've been very sorry about my dog in the background.
That's fine. I can hear you. I can hear you well.
Prices we pay for Zoom. I would put myself in the conservative end of the party, but I apply those conservative principles across the board. I backed gay marriage, for instance. I believe it's a conservative position to say that government shouldn't dictate who you can marry or who you should love. So I think that's right in line. Some people will say that makes me a rhino. I would say no, that makes me a devout conservative. And in other areas, with the discussions of cannabis, the father of the conservative movement, William F. Buckley, one of the most brilliant people to have ever lived. Look him up on YouTube. Those of you who haven't heard of him before, William F. Buckley. He was a big advocate of getting government out of some of these areas where people should be able to make their own personal choices. I don't back his overall policy on drugs. We can get into that in another day, but certainly he's recognized as a leading conservative. And he'd be a rhino by some people who accuse him of being. I'm a pretty devout conservative, but I'm open-minded, and I listen to the science, and I listen to where the policy makes sense. And I think that is also an obligation of conservatives.
Before you jump, I want to get one more in at least here. Sure. Looking forward to 2021. That, from what I understand, the entire legislature is up, as well as the governor, is up for re-election or new election for that matter. So what are your aspirations? Is there potential? Are you running for re-election? Do you know that already? Or are you looking at broader things, maybe even including something like a run for governor? Is that something that you would ever maybe think about?
Look, if you're in this for the right reasons, you want to maximize your ability to influence policy. Certainly being governor gives you a lot more power than a legislator, even if you're a majority in the legislature, which I hope happens with redistricting before this next election. So I'm not sure what I'd run for, but I'm running for something. I haven't exhausted, I think, my ability to influence policy. There's certainly plenty of policy that still needs to be influenced. I think I'm at the height of my voice. So I'll be running for something. It's flattering to be entertained within the governor's arena. We'll see. But I love being in the Senate. I love my district, and I love the debate and being part of it. So I'm going to be in the arena one way or another come next year.
Excellent. So no official announcement on Garden State debate today, but also not leaving anything out.
Look, I do want to say,
let the rumors swirl.
I do want to say we have a great pool of potential candidates. There's not a one whose name has been mentioned so far, including my Sheriff Sean Golden, John Bramnick, Jack Cirelli, Doug Steinhardt. We've got a really good bench of Republicans, and I hope I'm not leaving anyone who's had his name mentioned or her name mentioned, but we got a good group of people. So we're going to be well represented, whether it's O'Scanlan or any of those other folks. We're going to put up a really, really good set of arguments for the people of New Jersey to respond to and to endorse.
Excellent. Well, I know you got to jump. I appreciate your time for coming on. These things are very, very helpful for, I think, the state, the messaging and the education and everything that goes along with it. So I want to thank you a lot for coming on. Getting around different parts of the state and covering different topics like this is exponentially helpful. So thank you, and have a great Thanksgiving to you and your family. This will probably come out a few days after Thanksgiving, But we really appreciate your time, and hopefully we can get you back on maybe sometime in the new year.
I'd love that. Love these in-depth discussions, which we don't get a chance to have often enough. And look, the public doesn't get a chance to sit down for an hour and digest them either. And that's a problem, but we all have lives. So it's a balance, but really appreciate the opportunity for this. Would love to come back and do it again. And everybody have a safe and happy Thanksgiving and healthy.
Great. Thank you, Senator. Appreciate it. Have a good one.
Garden State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate. No joke, no frills. Garden State Debate. It's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate. For people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate. Garden State Debate. Garden State Debate.